We are doing a series on the attributes of God, but for our Reformation conference, I always like to do a lesson which ties in with our theme. And so today we are taking a look at the Dutch Further Reformation. I want to start by just reading one word from the book of Ephesians. So if you have a Bible, turn to Ephesians chapter 4. Maybe I'll go risky and read a whole verse. To understand the book of Ephesians, you need to know something about the structure of the book. The first three chapters deal with the doctrinal basis of the Christian faith. In a concise way, Paul gives you a lot of theology. And this is truth being proclaimed. This is the indicative of Christianity. And then chapter 4, verse 1 is the turning point, and the rest of the book is highly practical in nature. A lot of imperatives. Now look at verse 1. Therefore, and that's the key word, therefore, I, the prisoner of the Lord, implore you to walk in a manner worthy of the calling with which you have been called. Now, the word therefore is a hinge word. It points back to what I have just said in the last three chapters, all this doctrinal truth. Therefore, in light of all that truth, now here's how you need to live in order to live in a way that is worthy of this calling which you have. And it is this therefore that marks the turning of the tide from the doctrinal to the practical, from the theological to living it out in day-to-day Christian living. So keep that in mind as we go through this lesson on the Dutch Further Reformation. In Dutch, this Reformation is called the Nedere Reformatie. And that word Nedere in Dutch is not easily translated into English. There's no exact, precise equivalent in English. So as historians have tried to describe this period, they've tried different formulations, different descriptions. Sometimes it's been called the Second Reformation, but that really doesn't capture it very well. Sometimes this has been termed Dutch Puritanism, but that's really not very accurate either. So as these scholars have discussed and debated how to even name this in English, they've kind of settled on the word further, the Further Reformation. And part of the reason for that is to say, they weren't replacing the great move of God in the 1500s with something different and new, but rather they were developing it. They were taking it a step further. They were taking it deeper and closer. And so you could even call this the closer Reformation. It's an attempt to take it to its conclusions. Now, I think we're having sound problems. Okay. There's a definition that's offered here, and this comes from a group of scholars who do some translation in this, and this is in the handout if you have one. They say, the Nedere Reformatie is that movement within Dutch Reformed Church during the 17th and 18th centuries which, as a reaction to the declension or absence of a living faith, made both the personal experience of faith and godliness matters of central importance. From that perspective, the movement formulated substantial and procedural Reformation initiatives, submitting them to the proper ecclesiastical, political, and social agencies, and pursuing those initiatives through a further reformation of the church, society, and state in both word and deed. So what that says is they were seeing a declension or a decline of living faith. And they were concerned about this, so they said, we need to reassert personal godliness and a personal experience of faith. And let's do that through a variety of ways, and let's apply this to the church, to society, and to the state. So they're really taking the riches and the heritage of the Reformation in the 1500s, and they're saying, let's really apply this now. If you would, therefore, let's do something even more. Let's apply this in a thoroughgoing fashion. Now, to understand this period of Dutch further Reformation, you need to know something about the English connection, and especially the Puritan movement. The Puritan movement is often dated from 1560, but to understand that, you need to know the historical context, which is also important. So during the five-year reign of Queen Mary, Protestants were being brutally persecuted in Great Britain. This is the queen that came to be known as Bloody Mary for the many Protestants she martyred. This is the same Mary that John Knox opposed, primarily because of her desire to restore Roman Catholicism to both England and Scotland. When Mary died, her half-sister Elizabeth came to the throne of England. And Elizabeth was far better than Mary, but she proved to be not a great friend to the Reformation. So it was during Elizabeth's long tenure as queen that the Puritan movement really arose. The Puritans wanted to see the Reformation continued and deepened and advanced throughout Great Britain. Their Presbyterian counterparts in Scotland were the Covenanters. So these two movements, English Puritanism and Scottish Presbyterianism, come together to form the Westminster Assembly and to produce the Westminster Standards that we know and love. But during this early years of the Puritan movement, there is another facet as they were exerting influence in the Netherlands. Douglas Macmillan summarizes this influence in the Netherlands in this way. He says, both Puritans and Covenanters were to interact very intimately with religious life in the Netherlands. This linking helps identify the point at which British and Dutch Calvinism have their closest contact. Both these great spiritual movements were concerned with Second Reformation issues, and that concern was to shape the course of the 17th century in England and Scotland. Events there were, in turn, to reach deeply into the Netherlands and influencing its theology, deepening its spirituality, and linking it closely into the traumatized experiences of the British Church. We have to learn to look at the Second Reformation not as a small, localized, Scottish or even British phenomenon, but as a movement of international significance. He goes on, the divines of these groups held each other in high esteem. They influenced and enriched each other through personal contact and especially a vast array of translated writings, particularly from English into Dutch. More Reformed theological books were printed in 17th century Netherlands than in all other countries combined. These movements embraced similar ideals and bore similar roles to foster biblical and God-glorifying experiential piety and ethical precision in the life of individuals, churches, and the entire nation. So here we see these movements coming together and influencing each other. And one of the things which is really significant is the great outpouring of solid books being published in the Netherlands. There's also the issue of emigration. Due to the continuing persecutions of Puritans under King James I and King Charles I, many English Puritans fled to the Netherlands for protection and freedom. The Dutch had a tradition of religious tolerance, and the Netherlands was a safe haven for persecuted European Protestants, not only for Puritans from England, but even more so from the Huguenots in France. During the 17th century, tens of thousands of Anglo-Scottish believers of Puritan persuasion lived in the Netherlands. Those believers represented about 40 congregations and 350 ministers. The Dutch government allowed them to organize churches and form an English classis within the Dutch Reformed Church. Cornelis Pronk rightly notes, the presence of so many English and Scottish Puritans was bound to have some influence upon the Dutch churches. Many Dutch Reformed ministers were impressed by the practical divinity of the English Puritans. They saw it as a healthy corrective to the dry intellectualistic sermonizing that was becoming the trend in their churches. So you see God's providence at work. As the heat in England gets too hot, and as many of these Puritans are driven across the channel to the safety of the Netherlands, they bring influence. They bring Puritan influence. I think it's highly significant, especially knowing how hard-headed and ethnically close Dutch people can be, that they allowed an English classis to be formed within their church, and to have this whole subset of English Puritans functioning under the umbrella of the Dutch Reformed Church. Well, turning the page, there's also the matter of publishing. A hallmark of the Nedere Reformatie was the publication of theological books in Dutch, as well as the translation of English Puritan classics into the Dutch language. The Dutch Reformed Translation Society describes this as follows. To further their program of active, personal, spiritual, ecclesiastical, and social reformation, the writers of the Nedere Reformatie, the Dutch Further Reformation, produced some of the finest, most profound literature in the Protestant tradition. Furthermore, because the Dutch Reformed piety of the 17th century grew out of Reformatie and included among its founders and exponents, several erudite Orthodox theologians, such as Gibertus Vucis, Petrus van Maastricht, and Johannes Hornbeek, the works of the Nedere Reformatie do not give evidence of the kind of antagonism between theology and piety that belong to the pietist phase of German Lutheranism. Rather, the proponents of the Nedere Reformatie offered a balance of doctrine and piety, as well as theology and life, that has seldom been equaled in church history. Now, what that's saying is that they are bringing together orthodox theology, sound doctrine, and practical piety. Sometimes, not only in German movements, but other movements, those two are pitted against each other. But either you're orthodox in your doctrine, or you are going to be living for the Lord. In fact, we have a friend who is from the Netherlands, who studied here in the U.S. for a while, and when she went back home to the Netherlands, we asked her, Corrine, have you found a good church? And she said, well, there's a problem. There are good, sound churches that are doctrinally orthodox, but they are as dead as a doornail. On the other hand, you've got evangelical churches that are spiritually alive, but they're doctrinally fuzzy. And these two end up sometimes being pitted against each other. But what the Nedra Reformatie does is says, let's bring these two streams together. Let's see both and, not either or. Well, two English Puritan authors were particularly popular in the Netherlands, with their books being translated into Dutch. William Cooper, 18 editions of 10 translations, and William Perkins, who is often called the father of the Puritans in England, 71 editions of 29 translations. Dutch further Reformation divines also read the English Puritans widely. In fact, there was one of these further Reformation men who enjoyed reading the Puritans so much that he developed his English abilities to the point that he could preach and conduct worship services in English, even though he was a native Dutch speaker. And so they really saw the value of the English Puritans, and they read them, and they translated them, they circulated them, and they also promoted the theological connections that Puritanism was bringing. Well, next I'd like to look at three of the leading figures of the Nedra Reformatie. There are more, in fact there are many more, and there are some that might also be worthy of consideration, but I just chose three to kind of give you something of a flavor for this. The first one is Willem Teelink, and he is considered the father of the Nedra Reformatie. Willem Teelink was born in 1579 in the Netherlands. He studied law at St. Andrews in Scotland, and after receiving his doctorate from Poitiers, he went to live in England among the Puritans. He had heard about these Puritans, and he was curious. So he had gotten his academic training out of the way. He said, I'm going to go live among the Puritans for a time. And while he was there in England, he came to understand Calvinistic doctrine, but he also saw their deep spirituality and their reverent piety. These Puritans openly talked about the Bible and spiritual truths. They were very concerned for the state of their own souls. They strove to keep the Sabbath day holy and to be diligent in both private and family worship. They also sought to apply Christianity to public life and society. So in short, Teelink saw a kind of Christianity he had not known in his native Holland. It was during this time in England that Teelink felt the call to the ministry. So he married an English woman named Martha Greenden, who was a Puritan, and they moved together back to the Netherlands. He studied theology in Leiden under Franciscus Gomarus and James Arminius, boo, whom we heard about yesterday. In 1606, Teelink was ordained to the ministry. He continued to serve the church as a minister until his death at age 50, in 1629. The majority of his ministry was spent in Middelburg at a large and influential congregation there. During his years of ministry, Teelink wrote 127 books, the most famous being The Path of True Godliness. And amazingly, Teelink was the father of a large family, and he was sick for most of his years of ministry. And yet he was influential and productive. One of the things that Teelink had picked up from the Puritans was an approach to preaching which used just a plain, straightforward language. Rather than using all kinds of technical, theological jargon, rather than trotting out the Greek and the Hebrew, he just spoke in plain language to ordinary people. And his preaching was not, by all accounts, eloquent or flowery or outwardly impressive, but it was used by the Lord not only in his congregation, but more widely. In fact, one of the other people we'll look at in a second, Vuchus, heard T-Link preach, and he said, I wish that every preacher was like this. He just heard a plain, clear presentation of biblical truth. T-Link's sons went into the ministry, and so his ministry was extended through his own sons. The second person to look at for a minute is Hubertus Vuchus. Vuchus was born 10 years after T-Link, and Vuchus grew to become a very important theologian as well as a preacher. He studied theology at the University of Leiden, as T-Link had done. Vuchus also sat under Gomarus and Arminius, though he followed Gomarus's strict Calvinism, and he rejected the teachings of Arminius. In 1610, the Arminians won a temporary victory that led to an Arminian takeover of the University of Leiden. The Calvinists in the faculty were put out. They were fired. And the Arminians gained, for a short time, the upper hand. And this brought Vuchus's budding academic career to an abrupt halt. He was kind of on a track to be a Orthodox Calvinist scholar, and this just stopped it in its tracks. In 1611, Vuchus was ordained to the ministry and began what we would call today church planting in a predominantly Roman Catholic village. That was hard work, and they weren't all that receptive. There was a lot of public sin, and his ministry was plowing some pretty rocky ground. In 1617, he took a call to Houston, where he would serve for 17 years as pastor. Because of his diligent labors in battling the errors of both Roman Catholicism and Arminianism, Vuchus was appointed as a delegate to the Synod of Dort. He distinguished himself during that synod and gained close friendships with a number of the English Puritan delegates. Now, this is interesting because, as Dr. Godfrey told us yesterday, this was an international synod. And there were British Puritans who came and who were at the Synod of Dort. And it's there, as Vuchus is interacting with these Puritans, that he becomes even more solid in his commitment to a Puritan vision of Christianity and of the Christian life. Going on, in addition to being a first-rate theologian, an effective author, and a tireless preacher, Vuchus had a heart for foreign missions. He persuaded various Dutch trading companies to send missionaries on their ships to the distant parts of the world. H. A. Van Andel has said, Vuchus attempted not only to sketch the outlines of a solid theology of missions, that he was also the first who attempted seriously to give missiology a legitimate scientific place in the whole of theology. Joel Beakey says, it is remarkable that the greatest Dutch scholastic of Reformed Orthodoxy developed the first comprehensive Protestant theology of missions. In 1634, the new Academy of Utrecht offered him a professorship, which he accepted. He taught there for the next 42 years until his death in 1676. Vuchus lectured on systematic theology, ethics, church polity, logic, metaphysics, and the Hebrew, Arabic, and Syriac languages. Dr. Godfrey, do any of your faculty have that kind of a teaching load? This is a really remarkable spread of topics to be teaching on. In addition to this, he had a part-time preaching and pastoral schedule, which included visiting the sick and regularly catechizing the orphans of Utrecht. So in addition to all this lecturing, he's preaching on a half-time basis, and he is going to the orphans in the streets of Utrecht, and he's catechizing them. This man was just remarkable. The third figure to focus on is Wilhelmus Abrakel. Born in 1635, Wilhelmus Abrakel was the leading figure in the next generation of the further Reformation. At the age of 24, he was ordained, but due to a lack of open pulpits at the time, he had to wait several years before receiving a call to a congregation. And during those years of waiting, he studied under Vuchus in Utrecht. In 1662, he took a call to Exmora, Friesland. It was there that he was married to Sarah Nevius, the widow of another pastor, and apparently she was a great help to him in his ministry. From 1673 to 1683, he served a very large congregation in Leeuwarden. Oh, I skipped a sentence there. In 1665, he went to a larger congregation in Saverin, which proved much more fruitful. And then 73 to 83, he was in Leeuwarden. Now, there were several controversies during this time due to Abrakel's belief that political bodies should not exercise authority over the church. Now, as you read this and as you hear it for the first time, it seems like, oh, this guy was a troublemaker because he kept on getting into conflict. He kept on having these arguments. And he was censured at points. What was he concerned about? The state should not govern the church, which is a very Presbyterian and Puritan idea, and something that even goes back to Calvin in his days in Geneva. So here is Abrakel saying, you know, it's really the church that should govern her own affairs, and the state really doesn't have authority to exercise over the church. In 1683, he transferred to Rotterdam, where he continued ministering until his death in 1711. Abrakel is perhaps best known for his classic work, The Christian's Reasonable Service. The English translation by Bart Elshout was edited and published by Joel Beakey in 1995. Now, it's the first time that work appeared in English in 1995. That's not that long ago. That's just 20 years ago. Up until 20 years ago, this great work had been left in Dutch and was inaccessible to the English-speaking world. It is four volumes and runs 2,675 pages in length. Now, Beakey says that this work is more than a systematic theology. Abrakel's intent in writing is inescapable. He intensely wishes that the truth expounded may become an experiential reality in the hearts of those who read. In a masterful way, he establishes the crucial relationship between objective truth and the subjective experience of that truth. In the Netherlands, this book became as popular as Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress was in English circles. Beakey describes its impact as follows. For family worship, a typical 18th century Dutch farmer would read a selection from Father Abrakel every night to his family after the reading of Scripture. When he completed the whole, he would return to the beginning and read through it again. Reasonable Service went through 20 editions in the 18th century alone. It has been reprinted several times in Dutch in the 19th and 20th centuries as well. Now, this gives you just a picture, a little bit of the ordinary spiritual life of Dutch Christians. So you're a farmer, and you've been out with the cows or in the field, and you come in after a long day, and after you have your supper, it's time for family worship. And perhaps you sing a psalm, perhaps you read a portion of scripture, and then the father pulls off the shelf the Christian's reasonable service. And he turns to the section where they're reading, and he'll read maybe two or three pages. And if he has got enough energy to do it, he maybe discusses the content a bit with his children. And they do this every single day, week after week, month upon month, year after year. When he gets to the end of the 2,675 pages, he goes back to page one, and they work through it again. So depending on how fast they could read or work through it, a child who is born in a Dutch household may hear the complete Christian's reasonable service read to them by their father maybe three or four times before they graduate to adult life and get married and start doing the same thing in their own home circle. And this produces a great impact of practical Christian piety based on sound Orthodox theology. Now let me finish with five contributions of the further Reformation and why I think that this forgotten era really needs to be reconsidered. Now, first of all, it's an important affirmation of the theological contributions of the Reformation. As I said, the further Reformation did not replace or set aside the theology of the Reformation, but affirmed it wholeheartedly. They added their amen to the doctrinal insights of the 16th century and taught and defended that truth earnestly. So it's not as if they say, you know, the Reformers got it wrong and we need to reinvent the wheel. They're saying, you know what, those guys 100 years ago, they were right on. And we believe what they discovered or rediscovered, and we're putting it forward again. We're not going to just discard that heritage, but we want to affirm that heritage and celebrate that heritage, because it's the truth of God from the Word of God. So these further Reformation people are affirming again, amening, the great theological developments of the Protestant Reformation. A second contribution is a needed emphasis on piety to prevent dead orthodoxy within Calvinism. The tendency is often for Orthodox Calvinists to take their orthodoxy for granted and to be slowly lulled to sleep. Without an emphasis on practical godliness, all of that good theology seems like so much theory. Dead orthodoxy is a terrible thing, because you've got the riches of truth within your grasp, but you're dry and dead and dull to the implications. And it's just a bunch of theory that you may be able to assent to, but it's really not impacting your life. It's not changing how you handle your relationships. It's just a bunch of theory. And whenever you end up with a theoretical Christianity, you really don't even have orthodoxy anymore. The orthodoxy of dead orthodoxy is really not real orthodoxy. It ends up becoming dead heresy because you're not living it out. You may believe the indicatives, but you're not believing the imperatives enough to do anything with it. And so gradually you lose even those truths that you claim to treasure. And so this movement, the Dutch Further Reformation in the Netherlands, and the English Puritans are both saying we need practical piety, real godliness, to keep us from dead orthodoxy. A third contribution, the demonstration that these two streams, orthodox theology and practical godliness, are not antithetical to one another, but actually intersect into a great flowing river of real Christianity. It doesn't have to be either or. You don't have to pick your poison. Say, well, we'll take the doctrinal orthodoxy for 20, but we're not going to really play on the practical godliness because that's not going to fit. Now, this movement, and Puritanism too, says, no, these two go together. They belong together. Bring them together, and you have the genius of the Reformation. You have real Calvinism here. You've got not a dead orthodoxy, you've got a living orthodoxy. It's hard to say which one is really worse, dead orthodoxy or blind zeal. The one is lifeless, the other is lively but unpredictable and ungoverned. So the best situation is not either or, it's both and. Let us have a lively orthodoxy, an applied orthodoxy, an orthodoxy that lives out the faith with integrity to the truth and a concern for real Christianity in everyday life. It's what these people in the Netherlands were trying to promote. A fourth contribution, an effort to apply this potent combination within the home, the church, society, and the world. Due to the continual intrigues of England involving both the monarchy and parliament, the Puritans never really had an extended peaceful period within which to apply their principles to all circles of human society. There was simply too much infighting to allow them the liberty to work these things out in their fullness. But the Dutch experience was quite different, with relative peace within society so that the further Reformation could be implemented more broadly. So here is where maybe the Dutch further Reformation goes further beyond what the English Puritans could do. Because the English Puritans were always playing this chess game with the king or the parliament, and over here in the Dutch Republic, there's relative peace to say, let's work this all out. Let's apply this to the family. Let's put this into the life of the church. Let's apply this kind of Christianity in society more broadly and in the state. And so the Dutch experiment is actually much fuller than the Puritans ever had the opportunity for. And then finally, a rich treasure trove of sound and solid books. Like their English Puritan cousins, the Dutch Further Reformation divines were voluminous in their output of useful and encouraging books. And I think this is where we can be benefited ourselves by taking time to read and digest their written works. So, here are some reading suggestions. Take up and read. The first one that I would suggest is The Christian's Reasonable Service. It's a large resource covering systematic theology, ethics, and practical Christianity. It's very readable for people of all ages. The four-volume hardcover is only $100 from Reformation Heritage Books. The Kindle version is $6.95 in the Kindle store. You can guess which one I have. Which else would the Dutchman buy? $100? $6.95. Well, that's easy. I use this, and I do sometimes quote it in sermons and teaching. It's very solid, but it's very pastoral. You've got that nice blend of, you know, good, straight, orthodox, systematic theology, but then practical applications of it, and it becomes very warm, very accessible. A second book, I have actually my copy here, Meet the Puritans. It's a big book. Joel Beakey and Randall Peterson have put together this collection of short biographies on leading Puritans, including 12 men from the further Reformation. This is a guide to the Puritans if you've never had any acquaintance with the Puritans. And it gives you 3 or 4 pages on Vuchus. It gives you, 5 or 6 pages on William Perkins. And it tells you which of their books are available in print today. Another one is The Path of True Godliness by Willem Teelink. I picked this up. I'm starting into it. It's quite good. It's going to be somewhat intellectually challenging to some, but not impossible. It is the most popular volume in a series that's entitled Classics of Reformed Spirituality, which is being produced by Reformed Heritage Books. Paperback is $11. It's not currently available as an ebook. Another one, Spiritual Desertion by Vuchus and Hornbeek, and there's a little description there. Again, available easily for $11. This one kind of caught my eye, maybe for some of our young families, The Duties of Parents by Jacobus Coleman. And you can see the table of contents and some very important things, like how to teach children to pray, rules for living a true faith, all kinds of practical stuff. For further information, if you want to go on the web to the Dutch Reformed Translation Society, they've got a website. And then also if you want to see the whole Classics of Reformed Spirituality series, there's a website there. In this Classics of Reformed Spirituality, Beakey and his friends are translating, I think, 2 titles per year and getting some of these hidden Dutch classics into English and made available.